ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Have you ever wondered why everyone's worried about microplastics?
Or what the best time of day is to exercise?
And why are some people left-handed, Tegan?
Well, the best people are. Anyway, we've got the show for you. It's called What's That Rash?
Where we answer the health questions everyone's asking. I'm physician and journalist Dr. Norman Swan.
And I'm health reporter Tegan Taylor.
And we promise we're not here to sell you supplements.
It is surprisingly hard to find podcast hosts who aren't.
But we do want you to search for What's That Rash in the ABC Listen app.
And we might answer your question next.
A horse-drawn carriage is rattling down the road, and in it, a young man stares out the window. He's in America, far from his London home. The year is 1860. All around him are other passengers, each of them lost in their own thoughts. Their journey seems, kind of uneventful. That is, until something happens. The brakes fail. The horses come loose and they gallop away. The coach, it lurches, it tumbles, and it spews the travellers out onto the road.
And he's thrown out of the stagecoach as it hits a tree. Another passenger was killed and another one was seriously wounded.
As he's thrown to the ground, the man's head hits a rock and he's unconscious. And it seems like he will never wake up. Until, miraculously, he does.
He didn't know where he was. He didn't remember what had happened. And it took him a long time to recuperate.
This will be, in retrospect at least, a turning point in his life. Because during his very long recovery, he takes up a hobby that will soon become an obsession.
He became a well-known and accomplished photographer with an intense curiosity. And his quest is to find a place for himself in the world.
Oh boy, did he find himself in the world. A world of invention, of fake names, gambling, lawsuits, and killing. Plus a wild experiment that would one day lead to modern day cinema.
His passion and his curiosity moves him towards terrific accomplishments. His technological wizardry is something that I really am in awe of, knowing how difficult it was to do what he did in those days.
I'm Mark Fennell, and yes, a murderer helped invent the movies. Before cinema, before Hollywood, before we even understood how to make pictures move, there was that man constantly reinventing himself, from a bookseller to a photographer to an alleged fraud. And yes, eventually, a killer. But between the scandals and the aliases, he conducted an experiment that would change the way we watch. And no one saw it coming.
So I think he was ambitious. He was a showman, a good businessman, a brilliant inventor, multifaceted a man. And then eccentric, possessive, jealous, aggressive, and all of those emotional attributes that came after in his later life.
Oh, that is a lot of adjectives for one man. But I think it does give you a pretty good foregrounding of where we're going to go over the next half hour. So the man in question was a British gentleman by the name of Edward Muybridge, and the woman describing him goes by the name of Martha Braun.
I am the retired director of a university master's program in photographic and film preservation in Toronto.
So where does the interest in film and photographs and the image, where does all that begin for you?
Good question. I started with a degree in art history, and the images, instead of being paintings or sculpture, or the material changed, and I became interested in photography. And then I was part of a very important discovery of negatives, 2000 negatives, by a French physiologist called Marais. And that got me started looking at photographs of motion, and then I discovered Muybridge.
So if I had walked up to Edward Muybridge in Victorian England, what I understand is the person in front of me would have been quite striking. They would have stood out. Why is that?
Nobody's asked me this question before. He had deep-set eyes. He had the shock of dark hair with a little bit of white and kind of strong features, I would say, and an intense stare, an intense energy that went with an intense curiosity. He's interested in, not in his father's world, his father was a corn salesman, but in the future world. You know, he is born in 1830. He's born in the time of the steam engine, and he's very much intensely focused, I would say, on the future.
So this dark-haired British gentleman with an intense stare goes by the name of Edward Muybridge, except it turns out that was not the name he was born with.
No, he was born as Muggeridge, and then he went to the United States and became Muybridge. He did make a trip to Latin America where he called himself Eduardo Santiago Muybridge, then Muybridge. And on his tombstone is May, M-A-Y Bridge.
Okay, so what is going on here? What's with the constant reinvention of his name? What's he doing there?
Constantly reinventing himself, I would say. I'd associate the name change with the person change.
And his first incarnation was as a bookseller and a publisher in America in the 1850s.
He's selling books, mostly of prints, of pictures, or let me put it another way, illustrated books, which he gets from London and then binds first in New York and then ultimately in San Francisco.
And it's here, in America, that he has that horrific stagecoach accident.
He woke up, he didn't know where he was, he didn't remember what had happened, and it took him a long time to recuperate in Arkansas and then New York and then finally in London. He sued the stagecoach company, by the way, another aspect of his personality, very litigious.
Over the years, there's been a little bit of commentary, I guess, on the effect that accident had on Muybridge's personality.
Hitting his head seems to account for all of the factors, his possessiveness, his jealousy, his quick emotions, his anger, and most importantly, his eccentricity. So there's a medical writers who suggest that the knock on the head created a frontal lobal injury, and that changed his personality completely.
It was during that recovery process that Edward became obsessed with photography. He learned all the craft, which, it has to be said, in the mid-1800s was no small feat.
Wasn't just picking up a camera and pushing a button in those days. It was a very complex and technologically difficult thing to do. You had glass plates, you had to put collodion on them, you had to have very large cameras that were difficult to work with. And we have no idea who he studied with to learn the techniques, but he returns to San Francisco, a really accomplished photographer, and he starts by focusing on the landscape of the West.
Muybridge roamed the western states of America in a one-horse carriage, and it was packed with his photography equipment, including, believe it or not, a mobile darkroom. He takes photos of majestic scenes like Yosemite Valley, and there is this one, and if you're near a computer, you should Google it right now. It's called Mirror Lake. It's from 1872, and it is breathtaking. So Muybridge has positioned the flat line of the horizon right in the middle of a frame. Above it is a mountain with undulating details, perfectly captured, the silhouettes of pine trees rising above the shrubs. There's light that pierces through the branches. But in the bottom of the frame is a lake, and it is perfectly still. And what you get is this balance of light and shade, and it is just right. It is like he has held up a mirror to the landscape.
The Yosemite pictures show you what a risk taker he was. These fabulously wide and high vistas were made by him climbing 2,000 feet up a mountain and sitting on a precipice. or going by mule into the darkest parts of the park and working there, taking tremendous risks. Number two, he invented something called a sky shade, which allowed him to modify or modulate the exposures of the plates that he was using, which was completely innovative at the time. He also manipulated the pictures so that he would print clouds from one negative onto a landscape of another negative.
So he's a bit of a photography wizard. And thanks to those Yosemite photos, he goes from obscurity to being world famous. And then his career takes an unexpected turn. It's all thanks to an invitation to work his camera magic on a farm owned by a man named Leland Stanford.
Leland Stanford is the governor, ex-governor of California, who has a remarkable racing stable, and he wants to have as much information as possible about training horses. And he hired Muybridge to photograph, first of all, his house, and then to see if Muybridge, with a camera, could help solve this controversy, that is, the gaits of a horse and whether or not the horse has all four legs off the ground in the gallop.
Okay, so when a horse gallops, right, is there ever a moment when all four legs are up? Is there a split second in the speed of the horse when that horse is, in fact, airborne?
Everybody was interested in the movement of a horse because you couldn't see it with your eye. So the idea of using a technology to seize a moment in the movement of a horse was a very, very exciting and alluring one.
So just Leland Stanford's a really interesting character, right? You mentioned he was a former California governor, but he was something of like a tycoon, wasn't he?
Oh, he was a robber baron. Let's call him that. He was one of the men who built the Transcontinental Railroad and made a huge fortune out of that.
I've heard him described as Elon Musk before Elon Musk existed.
I think that's a perfect description. Yeah, I like that.
Okay, so 19th century Elon Musk has made a fortune from the Transcontinental Railroad. He's turned his attention to racing horses. And to be able to train his horses properly to win, he wants to understand how they move. Now, this theory about pull the legs up in the air, that's been debated for years. It has polarized scientists of the day. But it wasn't just about winning horse races. This went to the heart of how this animal, this form of transport, operated.
So horse is so vital to everything, to war, to travel, to locomotion in general. How do you get around in those days? There were no cars, there were only horses. So how the horse actually moved was of vital importance throughout the world. Stanford had his own interest. Stanford wanted to train his trotters and his racehorses, and he thought if he had an idea of their movements, he could ameliorate their movements.
This is undoubtedly a curious assignment for Muybridge. He's gone from capturing landscapes, famously things that do not move, to having to photograph an animal to figure out how it runs. It's fair to say he's got his work cut out for him.
He does a number of experiments over a long period of time. And Muybridge sets up a whole system of one camera next to another to make a total of 12. He sets up a system where there are wires, trigger wires, along the path of the horse and gets a series of photographs which shows the horse in motion.
So 12 cameras in a row. And how are they being triggered? How does that work?
The horse trips the wire and the wire triggers the shutter, and the shutters are extremely rapid one after another. And that's the magic of Muybridge's system. There's a lot more to it. I mean, he has to have a white wall behind the horse. He puts white marble dust and lime on the ground. Everything is pure white. The horse is dark. His emulsions on his plates are very fast. So this is all Muybridge's technological brilliance. But he succeeds in getting a series of 12 images which show the phases of the horse's motion. And in one of them, the horse indeed has all four legs under its belly.
Bingo. Muybridge has done it. He has captured the moment where the horse is in full flight, and yes, none of its legs are touching the ground. He has proven the flying horse theory. But he also has these 12 sequential images of a horse. And at some point he realizes he can do something with these images.
He has 12 sequential images, and each image is a phase of motion. And he finds that he can recombine them and provide the illusion of motion, as if you're looking at, well, today as if you're looking at a film. So he makes drawings of the photographs, and he puts them on the edges of a disc, and he constructs a machine. And again, Muybridge is a brilliant, brilliant technologist. He constructs a machine called the zoopraxiscope.
Catchy.
Yeah, catchy. With which he can project, thus recombine, the movement of these animals and human beings and all sorts of other animals.
And this is the moving image.
Definitely the moving image.
So he built a device with the wildly unhelpful name of the zoopraxiscope, which you might recognize as an early version of the zoetrope. So, okay, picture this. You have a hollow cylinder, and in it is a series of thin slits cut into the side. Now, inside that cylinder, lining the wall, is a strip of images. In this case, a horse galloping. Each image, almost the same as the one before, just slightly shifted. When you spin the cylinder and you look through the slits, those gaps act like a shutter on a camera, so they control what your eye sees moment to moment. That's me clicking there. There you go. Your brain stitches those separate images together, and suddenly that horse isn't a series of pictures anymore. It's moving. It's a looping animation. It's motion.
It's a pioneer of motion picture animation. It's extraordinary what he did. And he became famous all over the world for it. It was published, these images of the horse, still images, were published all over the world in scientific journals. People finally saw how the horse moved. And he himself was invited to lecture with his zoopraxiscope, which essentially synthesizes the movements and proves the veracity of his pictures.
So Muybridge, who, by the way, at this point is like 50 years old, he has arrived. He's doing lectures around the world in cities like Paris and London. He's fated all over, and he is loving it.
Muybridge wants to be a celebrity, and he really has his moment once he travels with his zoopraxiscope.
In London, he is met with applause by the Royal Society and institutions, and he proudly shows his images to the Prince of Wales. But the whirlwind of celebrity screams to a halt when a certain book is published.
Stanford, in the meantime, has published a book with Muybridge's images made from the photographs. But Muybridge's name isn't there on the book. Muybridge got another Dr. Stillman to write the book. It's called The Horse in Motion. And Muybridge is simply like an employee. And therefore, the reaction in London was, you're a fraud. You didn't do this work. Somebody else did. And Muybridge's reputation, as he says, is completely destroyed.
He spent years trying to prove this hotly debated theory. Did it, and then now he's being told that he is a fraud. I think that would dent anyone's ego, and Edward Muybridge did not have a small ego. But what he does next is interesting. He does not disappear. He picks himself up, he sails back to America, he sues Stanford, and loses. But he's not done. No, no, no. If he can't win in court, he will prove it another way. By taking his work directly to the public and rebuilding his reputation in full view.
He sends out, again, Muybridge the showman, he sends out a prospectus for new works of motion, a new work on motion, and it's got an audience at the University of Pennsylvania, and there he starts on a huge work of the motion of men, women, children, and animals.
Incredible. So he's actually almost forced to prove that he can do it.
That's, yeah, yes. And not as an employee of Stanford, but as an investigator and even a scientist in his own right.
So Muybridge clearly set out to make a name for himself, clearly set out to be famous. And he does achieve that, but there is another side to his fame because he has a very dark chapter in his life. Tell me what happens.
Muybridge married a young woman called Flora, and he found one day a picture of their son. On the back was written, Little Harry. And Muybridge, discovering in this way that his son was not his son, but the son of Major Harry Larkins, who frequented his wife, gets a gun, gets on a train, goes to Conestoga to a mine where he knows Harry Larkins is, and shoots Harry Larkins dead in cold blood with the words, "This is a message from my wife." Lots of witnesses, and he's immediately confined and put on trial.
And this is the part I struggle to get my head around. Despite having shot dead a man in broad daylight, the trial goes surprisingly well for Muybridge.
His lawyer wanted to plead insanity exactly on the grounds of eccentricity, but the jury of 12 men absolved him with the explanation that they would have done the same thing. It was a crime of passion.
So he's an unusual character to kind of wrap your head around. He's certainly not a classical pioneering hero. He's got some rough edges and he does some incredibly reprehensible things in terms of murder. And yet he is one of the fathers of cinema, one of them. For you, how do you think we should regard him and his legacy?
Oh, I think he's an absolutely extraordinary mixture of a man who's interested in both art and science. I think that his passion and his curiosity moves him towards terrific accomplishments. His technological wizardry is something that I really am in awe of, knowing how difficult it was to do what he did in those days. And I think he's a kind of a crazy guy. Of the 783 pictures that he made at the University of Philadelphia, about 300 are of human beings, and half of those are naked women doing very odd things like dancing and crawling and climbing ladders. So I find that he just has created this treasure trove of imagery, these jokes and these fantasies, and he never stops being intriguing.
Edward Muybridge's legacy is complicated. Over the course of his life, he was many things. An obsessive tinkerer, a pioneer, and yes, in one shocking chapter, a murderer. But what he captured through his lens, and what he invited audiences to see inside those images, it was entirely new. As Marta puts it, these weren't just scientific experiments or technical curiosities. They were a glimpse at what motion pictures would become. Wonder at the technology, yes, but more importantly, delight in the spectacle it made possible.
It's not just the technical aspect of projecting, animating movement, but it's the content of early motion picture. Sex, jokes, fantasies, human beings. That's really what motion pictures are. That's what I understand his contribution to motion pictures to be. The content of those images that we all love to see. Drama, humor, fantasy. That's all in Muybridge.
On the one hand, Muybridge committed premeditated murder, and yet at the same time, he also mastered the moving image that has changed the way we see images and cinema now. How do you reconcile those two things? How do you make sense of those two sides of personality?
He stopped time in both instances, didn't he? He ended the life of a man in an instant. And maybe the motion studies that he does after that are simply this repetition compulsion of, let's use the word, shooting and stopping time.
Through motion, he stops time.
Yeah, it's through images, stopping the faces of bushes, stopping time repeatedly.
And that was Professor Marta Braun, retired director of photographic and film preservation at Ryerson University in Toronto. This episode of No One Saw It Coming was produced by Zoe Ferguson and Rebecca Metcalf on Gadigal Land in Sydney, Australia, for ABC Radio National. If you enjoyed it, please share it with people. You know what to do. I'm Mark Fennell, and I'll be back next week. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.